morning is United States against Groves. Mr. Cohen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. We're here today for the second time in this case. The first appeal resulted in this court reversing Mr. Groves' conviction for possession, a felon in possession of a weapon for insufficient evidence. This court then remanded this case back to the district court for a further determination on the Fourth Amendment issue. Specifically, this court cited the case of Georgia versus Randolph, a decision by the Supreme Court of the United States. That case was decided subsequent to the first briefing and oral argument in this case. The case was remanded back to Judge Sharp, who made further findings of fact and again denied the defendant's motion to suppress. I would assert to this court that the defendant's motion to suppress should have been granted based upon Georgia versus Randolph. While the Georgia versus Randolph case specifically was limited to a co-tenant being in possession of the premises at the time the other co-tenant gave consent, this case, I think, is a logical extension of the Randolph case.
How does one logically extend a decision that admits that it is completely illogical?
Exactly.
It's a very difficult thing to do, Your Honor, and as I struggle with it, I think when you look at justice...
Look, the Supreme Court, the majority says this is a completely arbitrary rule. We're preserving an old doctrine and adopting this arbitrary rule, and the rule, arbitrary or not, is that if somebody is standing in the doorway and says, I don't consent, you can't search.
Yes.
Well, there we are, one would think.
Well, and in this case, when...
And more precisely, there he wasn't. And,
yeah. Well, he was there when the police first came to his apartment, and they asked him if...
It's not Miranda, where after you assert your right to counsel, the police can't try again.
Well, I think as we apply common sense to this, Your Honor, I think that...
That's the last thing one wants to do with decisions of the Supreme Court.
Well, as we struggle to do that, Your Honor, I would point out that because Mr. Grove was present at the time that he initially denied consent to search, twice, in fact, and then...
Let me ask you, has the Supreme Court, for that matter, have we... ever said that if somebody refuses a request to consent to search, the police can't ask again or try again in some other way?
No, but they didn't ask Mr. Grove in this case.
Yeah, who cares? Right? If you don't have a doctrine like the Edwards overlay on Miranda, if it's never been recognized, then it's very difficult to see how it can be shoehorned into Georgia against Randolph.
Well,
one might say we have this other doctrine, we combine it with Georgia against Randolph, and we've got something, but we don't have this other doctrine. There's no Edwards-ish overlay on consents to search.
I think that if you look at the Randolph decision and the clear, bright-line rule that the Supreme Court put down, that if you're in physical possession of the premises at the time and you deny your consent to search, a co-tenant can't override that. In this case, Mr. Grove initially was present and did in fact deny any consent to search, so that when you look at the totality of the circumstances, I believe you must do in this case, two significant factors are that the initial denial of consent by Mr. Grove, and the fact that the officers, after initially being denied consent to enter, went to a magistrate to seek to get a warrant, and that application was denied by Magistrate Nectarline.
Well, I can't. They were South Bend street officers, police officers, right, the first time?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it was a Project Disarm Task Force agents the second time.
Yes, but they work together with the South Bend police. I think Batani is a South Bend police officer as well as being a Project Disarm officer. And Batani, as he testified at the motion to suppress hearing, was well aware that the first time Groves refused to consent. So the officers, when they went to the home the second time, were well aware that Mr. Groves had already refused to consent for a search.
See, I think the big problem here is that in Randall, the court emphasized the importance of the objector being physically present. Now, it's true that you've argued that the police effectively removed him from the scene by not letting his lady friend, Miss Foster, call him when she requested to do so. But is what you're saying is that her refusal to call him could be viewed as a removal from the premises under Randolph?
I think it would be viewed as not quite that way, Your Honor. I think it's a removal of the objector from the premises by virtue of the fact that Agent Batani showed up at the apartment knowing that the objector would not be present at that time, specifically planning it so that no one would, so he couldn't object.
Pretty clever.
Well, whether it's clever or not, it seems to not. It would be permitting a police officer to enter the back door of a residence after one tenant.
What's wrong with that? If you go up to somebody and he says, "I won't talk to you" or "I won't consent," you can infiltrate somebody. That, of course, is what brought down Jimmy Hoffa. And there's no rule against that. I mean, given the outcome of cases like Hoffa and the other infiltration, impersonation, false friend cases, why is there any problem here?
Well, because the officers knew at the time that they showed up that consent had already been refused.
That Jimmy Hoffa was denying them any consent to access to his records, but the police infiltrated, the FBI infiltrated a false friend, Grady Parton. Remember him? They infiltrate Grady Parton, and the Supreme Court says Parton consented to the search, the recording, and so on. The police surely knew that Hoffa was rejecting everything. Now, if Parton could consent, why can't Foster?
Well, I think that decision was also before the Randolph decision. I think Randolph might require a reexamination of that decision.
The argument that Randolph is going to require the overruling of U.S. against Hoffa is not going to get you any votes on the Supreme Court, I should think.
In this case, in addition to applying Randolph for purposes of granting this motion to suppress, there are additional reasons why this court should grant the defendant's motion to suppress. There are significant questions concerning Shante Foster's voluntary giving of consent in this case. When this court remanded this case back down to Judge Sharp, one of the things this court wanted the district court to do was to consider whether or not there was actual or apparent authority by Foster to give consent and whether or not her consent was overborne by the coercion from Agent Batani, who threatened to take her child if she didn't consent to search of the house. When you look at the first time that Agent Batani spoke to Shante Foster, she immediately told him that she wasn't sure that she could do anything without speaking to her boyfriend, Mr. Groves. I think that shows that her authority was limited and that the police knew that her authority was limited at that time. I would like to reserve a short period of time for rebuttal, unless the court has any follow-up question at this time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Cohen.
You.
Mr. Schmidt.
May it please the court. The word removal requires some active participation with the police or law enforcement officers with the potential objector. If you're going to talk about removing someone from the scene, if they're not physically present, they'd have to be involved with them in some way. Here the evidence is undisputed that the federal agents, the Project Disarm Task Force agents, were not in any way involved with the other potential objector, Mr. Groves, on the day that the consent was obtained and the search was done. That was July 21st, 2004. Indeed, they didn't talk to him that day. They had no dealings with him that day. They didn't talk to him that week. The only dealings that other law enforcement officers had, local police had, were 16 days earlier when Mr. Groves refused consent. And, of course, there is no doctrine that says the police could not have approached Mr. Groves again and asked him again for his consent. And similarly, there's no reason why the police could not have approached Ms. Foster for her consent.
Would your argument be the same if the gap, rather than 16 days, had been 2 hours? In other words, he said, and then, he goes to the store. And then they come back, and, Ms. Foster's sitting there.
I would concede it would be a more difficult argument to make, but under Georgia v. Randolph, the way the Supreme Court drew the line and acknowledged in writing that particular decision that it was drawing a very firm, formal line, I think the doctrine would still hold. The argument would still hold water, that you could go back for someone else's consent, and if they, the other potential objector is not physically present, and the police has not effectively removed or not actually removed the potential objector, then the consent would be valid.
In Randolph, the court discussed removing potentially objecting co-tenants. Here, of course, we have a co-tenant, Mr. Groves, who had already voiced a strong objection, to say the least. In other words, he's not a potential objector. He's an actual objector. Does that change the analysis at all?
I think the relevant question, Your Honor, is what was Mr. Groves' status on July 21st, 2004, not July 5th, 2004? And on July 21st, he was a potential objector because nobody knew what he was going to say on that particular day. No one asked him. He wasn't around. In fact, the law enforcement officers had had no dealings with him since July 5th, 2004. So I would argue that he's a potential objector on that date, just as the Supreme Court suggested.
Yeah, it's not a fiction in your view.
No, Your Honor.
Once somebody says no.
No, I think very easily he could have changed his mind. In fact, he could have swept the apartment more thoroughly than he did with respect to the firearm and said, sure, come on in. And then he would have had the police off his back. So he could well have changed his mind. On the other side of things, this court asked the district court judge to make more detailed findings on the issues of authority and voluntariness. And the court did precisely that, wrote a much more detailed, factually oriented order, finding that Ms. Shanta Foster, the live-in girlfriend, who clearly had authority, she had keys to the apartment, she lived there, she not only lived there herself, but she lived there with her daughter, she cleaned the apartment from top to bottom, her possessions were there, indeed she threw out the defendant's ammunition on the very nightstand where further ammunition was found. She had thrown out some ammunition some months before, she said. She registered her daughter for school from that address. She got the phone. She paid the phone bill. She got mail there. I can't think of more indicia of actual and apparent authority than involving Shanta Foster. And on the question of consent, Judge Sharp, who was there at the suppression hearing, judged that she simply was not credible. She was caught in multiple lies as to where she lived, as to where she had registered her daughter, as to what her phone number was, all these issues, and the way she testified and deemed Agent Batani's testimony clear and credible and indicated that, made an express factual finding that's not clearly erroneous, that he never threatened her, he never coerced her, he never threatened to arrest her, he never threatened to take her child downtown. And so there was voluntary consent from a person who clearly had authority, and I think Georgia v. Randolph has no application here. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Anything further, Mr. Cohen? You probably have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Specifically, I would direct the Court's attention to that portion of the Randolph decision where Justice Souter says, so long as there is no evidence that the police have removed the potentially objecting tenant from the entrance for the sake of avoiding a possible objection, then the practical rule would apply. But that's precisely what happened here. Agent Patani...
How'd they remove him? He went to work voluntarily.
Well, because they knew that he wasn't going to be there.
The Davidians hold up inside.
He knew that they weren't going to be there, Your Honor, that Mr. Groves wasn't going to be there when they got to the apartment, and therefore the previous objection would not be there.
But that just, you know, it treats words as silly putty if we say removing someone from the scene and waiting until he walks away voluntarily are all the same.
In this instance, they are the same. And when the defendant said no, I think in this case no means no. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Cohen. We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you provided to us. And the case is taken under advisement.